I think sometimes success has a momentum to it that can be quite hard to sort of feel like you own, or at least can see through and make it relevant to you.
I've just had a conversation with the woman who needs no introduction. If I just say kitchen disco, you're going to know who I'm talking about. I was obviously speaking to Sophie Ellis-Bextor, the pop icon behind songs that, I don't know, have just shaped my life, really. Murder on the Dance Floor, Groove Jet, and now her brilliantly and hugely empowering album, Perimenopop. And we spoke a lot towards the end of the podcast about just how liberating, I think, releasing an album, giving us sort of permission to come out of now, thankfully, knowing about menopause, knowing about this whole stage, maybe then going through the fear into this album, onto the dance floor. And, you know, Sophie is just a really, really nice woman. She has her feet firmly on the ground, even when she talks about her music career, parenting, how she manages her world and life. It really made me feel quite calm and centered. She has a serenity around her. And it's really, really quite a wonderful thing to be able to hold that feeling whilst being this utterly successful generational pop artist who just, you won't see it, but just is so beautiful as well. The whole thing was just, you know, I want to be like her when I grow up, even though she's 2 years younger than me. This conversation's full of laughter and reflecting on real life moments, and it's so relatable, and it definitely makes you want to dig out your sequins and your platforms and your, I don't know, leotards, if any of you wore them, and get dancing, because she just brings joy, Sophie. She's enthusiasm really encapsulated in a midlife woman, and I'm so glad to know her. So this is definitely one to enjoy.
Bow your head and let your eyelids close on down. Where we're going, you won't need to bring your frown.
Hi, I'm Holly Tucker, and welcome to my podcast, Conversations of Inspiration. I've reached out to founders and those who simply inspire me to share their hard-earned wisdom with you. My hope is that collectively, these remarkable realizations will help you on your own journey. I like to think of it as inspiration for life. So let's begin this week's conversation of inspiration. Sophie, finally, you're here on Conversations of Inspiration.
Yay!
I just can't believe it. I've wanted to record this podcast with you for years, and I'm so excited about this, but you are very busy and it's a miraculous day off. Am I right in thinking this? And you've allowed us to take some of your time.
It's all good. I'm super happy. I got back from tour last week, and this week I've been doing nice things during the day, but I've just kept myself so I can always take the kids to school and be here after school. And you know, there's like quite a lot of like home things to catch up on as well. So I've just been really enjoying bedding back in, although I still haven't unpacked all my stuff from tour. There's piles upstairs to go through. That's my next project.
I can only imagine what that suitcase looks like. I mean, as you mentioned, you're a busy lady, and right now you're in the middle of this tour celebrating Perimenopop.
Yeah.
I mean, what a name. And you recently performed Milan, Zurich, Paris, Amsterdam, the list goes on. And firstly, no one needs an introduction to Sophie Ellis-Bextor. Obviously, I'm just calling her Sophie, everyone, but this is Sophie Ellis-Bextor. We are talking about her tour, but also when I've been looking at your stories and your posts, there is something about that atmosphere that I'm not there, but it feels like every molecule of air is full of joy.
Oh, that's so nice.
Is that what it's like?
I definitely think there's something very special about live performance. And for all the stuff that I do, it's the thing that I probably care the most about and that can satisfy my soul the quickest. Because I always think of gigs a bit like a date, you know, and you're just really hoping it goes well and that you guys, that you get on and that maybe there'll be a second date. And so there's a sort of, it's like a process of getting to know one another as quick as possible. And different venues, different crowds have a slightly different mood, different days of the week. So my job when I come out is to sort of work out how to tessellate with that energy as quickly as possible so that we can get where we need to go. And I've always just quite enjoyed the challenge, I think.
Yeah, I love that. I've never even thought of that, but you're right. It must just have a different atmosphere wherever it is, and you're sort of trying to sense it and pick it up and change it and morph it and things. I mean, it really is. It's there feels like the relationship you have with everyone watching you is a very special one, and it feels powerful. And it also feels like you're having the best time. And are you able to savor that? Like, I've never asked a pop star that. Like, are you able to savor what's happening right there and then?
That's a really good question. I mean, I think there's probably a few layers to it, really. And firstly, I would say, without sounding too sort of Enid Blyton about it, I think especially since lockdown, when everything obviously went quiet and all the live venues stopped being open, I'm so aware of how special it is if someone chooses to spend an evening, you know, if they come to a gig. I think, you know, you used to feel part of a big mechanism where that's just what was happening and that was a whole culture. But now I see it as more of like individuals choosing to deviate their plans to come. So I think that does lead to a higher level of appreciation for the whole thing. But also, I think the truth is that sometimes you have absolute liftoff and sometimes you're cultivating it more so that you can get to that state. I think I always reach it in the end, but sometimes it's quicker because sometimes it's just for whatever reason feels a bit more, you've got to make it happen a bit more. But I think sometimes when you come off stage, people will say, oh, did you enjoy that? And I think really you're kind of encouraged as an artist to think that it's all about your own enjoyment. But actually, I think that's like a happy next level.
Right.
Because really, my job is to make sure that everybody that comes feels that they made the right decision to come and see me.
Had a great time.
Yeah. So I suppose I feel like I'm that first. But I don't mean that in a cynical way. I mean more in a respectful way, really.
Yeah.
Like no one needs to know what's gone on in my day or if something's stressed me or if I found, you know, the makeup I was doing didn't come together like I hoped, or the dressing room was awkward. When I walk out on stage, I need to be in as good, it needs to be the same level for whatever type of show. Because even the gigs where you walk out and you think, okay, it's a festival, it's raining, it's a bit cold, there'll be someone in the crowd where I'm thinking, okay, well, what about that kid there? What if this is their first ever gig? Like, I need to make sure they walk away thinking, oh, that was, you know, some time
she
well
spent. She was all right.
Yeah. So I do kind of take all that in, really. So I guess, I usually do reach liftoff, but sometimes you're just, hopefully no one can tell when that happens for me.
I just love that. I think that one of the things that makes you a remarkable woman is obviously you're a pop icon, but you're a podcaster, wife, a mum of five beautiful boys. And just like your podcast that I've been honoured enough to be on, spinning all the plates. I mean, how do you find it when you're touring? And how has that experience evolved? You know, as you've been evolving over the decades and your kids have grown up, is there now a way that you have a relationship with touring and family life that you didn't before?
So it's yes and no. I think sometimes, because the touring in a lot of ways hasn't really shifted in terms of how it is viscerally. I know we're going to do my letter later, but I was thinking about the fact that like it's crazy really that I'm still getting on a tour bus, you know, all these years later. And like they're very similar, you know, the experience. So some of it is like joining back to, you know, that teenage version of me in a way. But I think what's happened with the live shows is just that there's less of a gap. I think I needed, when I was younger, a lot more of a run-up. I would feel like I had to put on a bit of armour. I would feel much more critical of myself. I would feel much more self-conscious. And now I really feel like there's hardly any inhibitions left, quite frankly, and I can chat away and occasionally almost go towards a sort of stand-up type of experience because I like to do like a little bit of chat and I'll have learned some facts about where I am. And yeah, I think the gap, that basically me off stage and me on stage is much more similar these days.
And what about leaving home for the tour? Like, is it the kids are growing up? Is there just less shit to do at home and just sort of stuff to get ready? Whereas when they were younger, the thought of being away...
I don't know. I mean, you know, from your, you know, raising your son, I think sometimes the bits where they get older is the bits where you can feel worse about leaving, actually. Yep. I think when they're little, it's, you know, the time passing for a three-year-old is very different to the time passing for a 13-year-old.
Yes.
And certainly, you know, my youngest is still, he's six, and the next one up's nearly 10. I'm about to miss his birthday again further. Well, my kids tell me it's been 4 years in a row. I don't think that's true. I think there's a bit of exaggeration there. But it does often fall that it's when I'm touring. And then the older ones were all started, like the two teenagers were both starting a new term at school. One of them was moving into a new school. So I did feel really spread thin. But thank goodness for technology, that really helps. I can keep in step with them. I still speak to them in the morning before school. My 13-year-old, I walk on FaceTime from the tube into the building every morning. So there's ways of doing it. But yeah, and I don't think it's got easy. I think I still struggle with that a lot. And I try not to go away for too long. And that's partly why I started the podcast. I think it's because I needed to talk to other working mothers just to see how they were dealing with that, I think.
I'm really interested. We're going to get into your childhood in a moment, but I'm interested in just this moment. You said, so I missed the birthday.
Yeah.
What's the conversation that's gone on over the last, kids say it's 4 years. I don't believe that. Is that just something that you have done by osmosis, creating respect to mum's career that can sometimes not fit into everybody's diary?
Yeah. Definitely.
What's that conversation? Because for some people, they'll be like, missing my kid's birthday. Oh my gosh. But then actually the reality is, this is life. This is true life. And this is, because it might help people out
definitely.
There, even just that thought process.
Oh yeah. I mean, look, I really do believe it. Birthdays are a season, not a day. So when I was little, my parents separated when I was four. So after I was four, I never had all my favourite people in one room for any of my birthdays. I was always with one or the other. So instead of seeing that as a sad thing, I couldn't have my birthday with both my parents, it'd be like, oh, I get to have two birthdays. I'll do a lot of that. I mean, like, there's always ways to make it up and also find the fun. And I'm all about, okay, so I can't be there on that day. Well, that day's a school day. I'll be back by the weekend when the party's happening. I'll be there for the sleepover. I'll be there for the cake. I'll be able to do all of that stuff. But also, okay, so you'll do something on your birthday with these people. And then on the weekend, we'll have your party with your friends. And then what about the following week? We have a big family dinner and we go to Chinatown and we eat dim sum and just draw it out. Like, okay, well, let's make five times the celebrations then. We'll have loads of them.
Yes.
Because otherwise,
I love that.
It's a bit like my older kids are a bit like, oh, it's my birthday and it's a school day. Can't have the day off. It's my birthday. And it's like, we don't always, you've got to find ways to find where the celebration is absolutely a thing. And then sometimes I'm away for work, but then I'm back other times.
Yeah.
So I think, I think I'm just quite pragmatic actually.
Yeah.
And also I do really mean it. I think, and obviously, I'd love to be there at the end of that school day to have a slice of cake with him. But we'll do it again at the weekend, and then we'll have it.
Yeah,
we'll just have more birthday. It's fine.
Celebration is a season, not just a single day.
Yeah. And that, same for Christmas.
Yeah, and I think for working parents, you know, start making up these things that are traditions in your home.
Definitely.
To work around what your unique situations are. There's no rule book here. And I think that that's such a permission for people who might be listening to this to do that, because heaven forbid, we beat each other up all the time.
Yeah, I know. But also I think, I don't even think it's just to other working parents, because actually it's also to anyone who has, you know, a family dynamic at Christmas. Like, Christmas is a classic one for people. They get very stressed about where are they going to be on Christmas Day. And you know, I absolutely respect and no judgment to those people where they're like, well, we've got breakfast with this family and then we're going to these people for lunch and then we do a walk with these people. I'm like, great. But actually, if you just take the pressure off that one day having to hold so much significance and you see people in lots of different ways around that time, it's okay to do that. Like, enjoy it. Yeah. Lounge into it. Like, let's stretch yourself into what that is for you. And actually, actually be a lot more luxurious.
And take the pressure cooker off.
Yeah.
I mean, God, absolutely.
Yeah, because otherwise it's so fraught, isn't it?
And so knackering.
So knackering,
as well. Jeez, so knackering. Everyone's nodding their head, by the way, right there. So I want to ask you about your childhood, going back to the Sophie growing up in West London in the early 80s. Your parents, Robin and Janet, separated, as you just mentioned, when you were little.
Mm-hmm.
And your mum, Janet, was a TV presenter on the iconic Blue Peter show. What was it like as a young child? And I mean, it was the show that we all watched, like Hawks. Do you know what I mean? It was just everything that we, as a certain age, just would absolutely love. And it was a sort of an institution for Gen Xers. So I'm wondering, when your mum was presenting that show, was it a blessing and a curse, or was it both? And am I right in reading that you did sell Blue Peter badges for 50p? Like, is that a made-up story or is that real?
No, it's not. Well, I suppose the aspect of it that's not too accurate is I don't think I ever really collected too much of the cash.
Because they would be worth quite a lot more than 50p now, I think.
Hey, this was, you know, this is primary school playground. That would have really been a handy...
You were a hustler
handy,
then.
Handy, I mean, 50p. But I think kids just very rarely bring cash to...
Yeah.
to primary. Do you know, they didn't then either. So that was, I think I just gave them away a few times. No, I think there's been way more positives to all of that than anything, as a drawback. I mean, I think I got a lot from my mum, not least a good work ethic.
Yeah.
And also probably some of that pragmatism I spoke about, because my mum was working really hard on Blue Peter and, you know, she wasn't always in when I got in from school. And I'm sure there'd be times when I wasn't with her for significant dates, but I think how she framed it was always quite sort of, I don't mean it to be harsh. She was always compassionate and empathetic, but I don't think there's ever been any sort of gloopy sentimentality around it, which definitely helped. And we were always so close. So the proof is in the pudding, really. And I think I found it quite exciting, really. And obviously it helped in the bigger picture that my parents were both involved in TV, which is not a conventional job, well, certainly for them, that in comparison to my friend's parents. So it meant when I thought about doing music, it wasn't like an unobtainable and mysterious thing. It had some framework in terms of, okay, yeah, that's going to be a job, a viable job. But also when my work started to take off, it meant that my parents were very good at checking in on me in more of an emotional sense rather than regarding my success with what was happening with my professional work. So that's probably been the biggest positive, I think.
And how did you enjoy school? Because I read that you were a little bit mischievous, a bit of a chatterbox, but you loved being in school plays, and that's your sort of dramatic DNA. Obviously, you became... sort of ignited at that point.
Yeah, I always liked doing plays. I mean, I don't know if I was that... I didn't really like getting in trouble. I wasn't good at that. I wouldn't say I was... I think the mischievous element maybe came in my teenage years. But when I was very little, I think I was...
Right.
Quite keen to kind of just sort of... I just never wanted any negative attention, really. I didn't like the idea of getting told off. But I also would be, relatively questioning of things, I think. And as a result, and I'm sure this is the same for lots of people, but I can remember times when teachers said things or taught things, and I thought, I don't think that's right. that kind of is funny, isn't it? They must think you're going to forget when you're like seven, but you kind of remember that stuff, don't you? I think primary school was quite tricky. I didn't have bucket loads of pals, and the ones I had, it was all a lot of chopping and changing. And I don't feel like I was really a particularly popular kid. It got a bit easier when I got to secondary school, just because I think you've got a few more people to find.
Yeah.
And I think my life outside of school started to develop, and the friends at school that resonated with, like going clubbing and music and things like that. We kind of had a world outside.
Maybe that's where the mischievous came in.
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, awful. I feel bad about it, really, because I was quite good until I was, like 15. And then I almost took flight overnight.
Your poor mum.
I know, awful. Like, as soon as I discovered boys, bands, booze, I was like, what have I been doing with my life until now?
What have I been doing since when I was 11? These three Bs.
Yeah, why was I bothering being such a goody-goody? Like, let's get out of here.
You went on to senior school in London, where you had three brilliant English teachers, and it sparked an interest in a career in journalism.
Yeah.
And you planned to read English at uni, but then fate led you to another direction, and you started singing and performing, and you were 17 when you joined your band called The Audience. Tell me about this experience and joining the band, and I suppose being in the spotlight at this young age, because it must have been hugely exciting. It was the late 90s. But it was a very different time then.
Loads of things were different.
We were ladettes and it was going on, and there was sort of a slightly, I think, a toxic culture, so to speak, with the celebrity magazines and TV shows and promoting sort of body shaming. So tell me about being that age and sort of the impact of that journey.
So, yeah, I started singing when I was 16, but I didn't actually go into... The band didn't really start to do anything until after I'd finished my A-levels. So I think for that 2 years during my A-levels where I was doing gigs, I was really just discovering that I'd found my thing. And I did really feel like that. I think almost from like the first show I did, I was like, this is the thing I want to do.
Wow.
So to be honest, the first bit after I finished my A-levels and then I signed the deal and I go off and we just start doing tours was just very exciting. And that momentum was so intoxicating. It was really only about after a year when the band had released an album that didn't chart as highly as the label had hoped. And we had this horrible year kind of staggering on, trying to make a second album, and then we got dropped. I think it was really that 4 years was like a sort of crash course in so many experiences that, that enlightened me to everything that would follow, really. And I think the toxic nature really was... It's so hard to... I mean, obviously, I didn't really term it like that then. No one did. That was just how it was.
No, I know. I was going to say, it's more of what we look at it now. It's like harassment now.
Oh, definitely.
And then, no. Well, it wasn't even noted. It was just what happened.
But then I think that continued for years, yeah. Actually. I mean, even when I released my solo album, and so this was like in the early noughties, and I mean, even as late as 2003, 2004, I had a journalist... like take a photograph up my skirt and put it in the papers. I had my head superimposed on like a woman in underwear and on the front cover of like the Sunday Sport. I mean, I don't think any of this stuff is legal now.
No, I don't think it is. Thank God.
But yeah, thank God. But I suppose the positive outcome, well, one of them has probably been talking to my peers now and realizing everybody felt the same. I think that's been quite healing, I would say.
Yeah.
But also, I think it just built a resilience, really, because it was very sink or swim. And the thing I sort of learned from a lot of it is firstly how to find the good people or the better people to stick with,
mm-hmm.
but also when to just observe, really. And just think, I'm not going to make a massive fuss about this, but I'm just going to slightly remove myself from that because that doesn't look so good. But, you know, some of it was just a steep learning curve, I suppose. But same for everybody. I mean, I think everybody, it was no matter what industry you were in, I'm sure there was a lot of that going on.
I think we sort of forget now. I mean, it's so frowned upon now, and treating people in the spotlight with respect. Mm. I mean, gosh, nothing's perfect, but I'm just saying that the sort of, we're much more conscious of it now. Whereas I think in the past, those that were consuming all of this, just celebrities just weren't even human necessarily. It was just something to watch and to talk about down the pub and all these sorts of things.
Yeah.
I'd love to get your thoughts on whether maybe all of that, because I sort of corrected myself there, has morphed into social media, though. So that toxicity, you know, has almost come off the, you know, the papers and the magazines that we were consuming, and has just all gone on to the new media that we're consuming, which is obviously social media. And how do you think we maybe manage celebrity now? And do you think lessons have been learnt? I know you've got quite a unique insight into that. So you've gone through all of that sort of stage, and now we're in this new era. Do you think things have got better, or do you think those in the limelight have not toughened up, but are able to sort of block it out more?
I think mainly things are better, but that's mainly thanks to language, because I think we have terminology for things that we didn't know how to articulate in the 90s and noughties. And also because we now don't have a monoculture in the same way, it means that people are better able to find their communities and the spaces where they want to talk more about certain things. So I think aspects of the way we interact with each other have actually improved. So things that used to be more taboo have been dialed down, mm-hmm. and have been brought more into light, and you can find spaces for that if you need it. And I think also... it's really fascinating to me that you can have artists that sell out big venues, but you won't hear that. We won't know them. Whereas
yes,
in the older days, you know, because there was this monoculture, you used to know what was number one, or
yes,
if it was a massive song on the radio. And also whatever was played on the radio over and over would dictate what we'd be then consuming, which still happens a bit, but not in the same way, I don't think. So I think by and large, it's produced a lot more subcultures, and it's probably helped me because I think when I was younger, pop music was so seen as youth-driven that I didn't even really know if I'd be able to or encouraged to make pop music in my 40s.
Yeah.
And so because people are now voting with their feet, and we have got all these other, you know, areas of community and conversation, it means you can exist within those worlds without it needing to be dictated by a boardroom of 12 people who decide what 6 songs we're going to have on the A-list, and that's that.
Yes.
So I think all those, that narrative that was being perpetuated was never coming from people up anyway. Like, my kids don't care how old people are that are singing the songs or anything.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think that aspect has been really positive. I suppose the negative things you're talking about, I think they get called out better, but I also think, I don't know, I think it's just still work in progress, isn't it? I mean, we still make the same mistakes about kindness and listening to people.
And I think maybe, was it that we used to have just such smaller amounts of media that we were consuming?
Mm.
So everyone was, you know, buying the Sun newspaper, let's just say, or doing whatever. Yeah. Whereas now, I mean, you just go scroll past a post. I mean, it's just cat litter tray, almost, you know, cat litter tray, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like paper, instantly.
I know, it's crazy, isn't it?
It's crazy. So, because it's less visible unless you get caught into one of those vortexes in which no one wants it, and the trolling. I wanted to also ask about that time, because, of course, despite what you went through, the band was just so successful, and you were voted one of the sexiest people in rock by Melody Maker. I love that. And I can imagine it must have felt like everything was coming together. And then a year later, you lost your record contract and you were only 20 years old.
Mm-hmm.
That must have been not only just a huge blow professionally and personally, but you're 20 when this happens. And that is a big knock. And I read that you have now said that you actually were quite grateful for this experience. Tell me why you were grateful. Did it give you some lessons that you were thankful for at a young age?
Yeah, definitely. I just think if everything had just kept being amazing, I just think I would be pretty intolerable, really. I think it would have really consolidated a not very healthy way of seeing the world. And I think it also absolutely crystallized my relationship with music, because I thought, well, am I only going to want to do this when, you know, it's fair weather? Or is this something I want to do no matter what? And I remember really thinking about that, and also taking responsibility, because I think, you know, the band, it was a great, exciting opportunity, but it went wrong very fast. And I wasn't really I hadn't really taken on all the things that it would have needed to make it right. I was kind of reacting to stuff a lot, I think, which was the dynamic that was set up, because I wasn't a writer.
I mean, you had just left school.
Well, yeah, but I'd finished my A-levels, but it had all been kind of laid out, and I wasn't one of the writers, and the whole way that the band had been...
Right, constructed.
That was really not me. I wasn't the spearhead of that. So I was kind of learning.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think after that, I thought, right, whatever happens from this point, I can't go around blaming anyone else for how it ends up. It's got to be on me. And I think that was helpful as well. But yeah, I felt like I'd probably got it all wrong before I was even like 21. So that was
21.
Not great.
Wow.
Yeah, because all my friends had gone to uni, and I was like, oh no, I should have done that. I'm just this person who's going to always be reminiscing about a band I was in the 90s, and it's going to be tragic.
And they hadn't even left uni yet.
Yeah, right. I was like, this is terrible.
I honestly can't believe I'm saying this. After 20 years of dreaming of creating a business show based in kindness, it's finally happening. My brand new TV series, Be Your Own Boss, is now out on ITV. It's a business show with a big heart, all about kindness, creativity, and what it really takes to turn your passion into a thriving business. Each week, I'll get a delivery at home from two small businesses in need of support and then head out to meet them in their workshops or kitchen tables to offer hands-on advice and a bit of encouragement to help them grow. It's full of heart, hope, and practical inspiration. Perfect if you've ever dreamed of starting your own thing or just love seeing people chase their passions. So tune in to Be Your Own Boss. Watch them all now on ITVX, and even better, share it with friends, family, and your followers to spread the word and support UK small businesses across the country. For now, though, let's get back to our conversation of inspiration. It was a horrible experience, but I've also read that you said, and it jumped out at me, and I wanted to ask you about this. For me, success is harder to navigate than failure or disappointment.
Yeah, definitely.
Can you elaborate on that?
I just think we're better cultured in how to navigate things not working out, because firstly, I think it's quite a British mindset, but also I think it's... It is just more familiar. It's a more familiar feeling, isn't it? When you're like, I'm hoping for this, but it's probably going to be that. But I think sometimes success has a momentum to it that can be quite hard to feel grounded inside of it and to sort of feel like you own, or at least can see through and make it relevant to you. Because once things are headed in an exciting direction, a lot of other people come out and they've all got ideas of where they can chime in with their thoughts. And it can be quite hard to keep your head straight, I think.
Yeah.
And you have to, success for me has to be have a little bit of an aim to it. It has to have like a sort of like a meaning so that it can make you feel still kind of sane within it.
Mm.
So I think last year when Murder on the Dance Floor, was having this extraordinary resurgence at the beginning of the year.
With Saltburn, wow.
Yes, exactly, which was happening very fast. You know, it sort of started in December and was galloping through like January, February. I just needed to kind of take a minute just to see through it. Like, okay, but how does this make sense with all the other things I already had planned for this year?
Mm-hmm.
So that I don't end up losing my mind and doing something crazy that doesn't make any sense, really. Or I look back and I go, oh, I was acting almost a bit drunk there, you know?
Yeah, I totally know what you mean. Being caught up in the moment and just doing something that someone else is trying to sort of potentially, and I like what you said about you get lots of other people coming in on success. I mean, failure and the graft is quite a lonely place. No one wants to do that. It's not actually very fun. And then, so why would anyone want to come in when you're having to do that bit? But the fun bit, you know, when it's all going well, you know, how many people would like to, I mean, I'm being cynical, take a slice of it or be in the part of the action. And so you're really right. And I'd never thought about that. Maybe because I'm still in the gritty, grafty stage, Sophie. I haven't quite got there yet. But, you know, it's not losing your head and not being drunk on it.
I think that's the thing. And actually, I mean, you say that, but you obviously, that's a sign of your ambition, I would say, because there's obviously lots that you've achieved that is incredibly successful. But I think that's also being quite sober about the work that's needed to maintain it.
Yeah.
And I think, to be fair, even with my line of work, I'm very hardwired to be mindful that, you know, I don't know what happens the year after next. And my diary could be empty and stay empty. So I think you kind of, there's always like that slight, you know, prod in your back of like, come on, chat on to the next bit, please.
Yeah.
But that whole adage about success has many fathers and failure as an orphan, I think is very true.
Oh, it absolutely is. And I think everything you said so far feels like a woman that really knows herself. And obviously, that's one of the biggest gifts that we can have. And for me, one of the things I would say is I really see in you then and now is poise. And you have this incredible poise that I think defines who you are. And I read in your book that you said, it's been my goal to be unapologetic, kind, considerate, but clear with my boundaries. And I love that. Do you think it's something that just comes with age? Or I'm wondering if you think that now younger women feel this too. And potentially we've been talking about social media and how that's completely changed our worlds. And, you know, even things like your kids don't care how old someone is. You know, when you were just talking about that, I was thinking, when you were younger, you didn't care what you were doing in your 40s. I mean, we didn't think like that. Whereas I think potentially people look at, I don't know, different times, but poise comes to mind when I look at you and you speak and things like that. What do you think where that's come from and about women of this now? And do you think we operate differently?
I don't know. I mean, I suppose some of it I think is kind of just about knowing yourself, but also knowing what works for you. And I think for me, keeping my bandwidth in terms of how I deal with stuff fairly tidy has actually probably been more of sometimes a coping mechanism or just a way of taking stock. Because in the times when I have been more inclined towards a more dramatic highs and lows, it doesn't really serve me very well and I don't feel as good. And I think I'm just one of those people that quite likes feeling quite measured. It doesn't mean I don't do silly things, but that's still quite a private thing, I think. Yeah. Maybe less so these days.
Yeah.
But I think for a long time, that was a way of kind of keeping my cards quite close to my chest.
And what do you mean by that? When you say keeping your bandwidth?
I suppose just not ever wanting people to know if they hurt you. Yeah, I just don't really... I suppose I think even things like when I did Strictly and there'd be talk about, I don't know, when you're going to cry or something. And I was like, well, I won't be doing that. Like I already knew when I started that. Like,
yeah,
I will give this all of me and I will really apply myself. But I will not be crying on this program.
Right,
you know, like just things you just choices you make for yourself. Because
yes,
I think that's just how I've been a bit wired, and it serves me well because then I can feel like I've kept some things for myself.
Right, yes.
And maybe that's always been quite important. And I think some of that's quite conscious. I don't mean cynical, I just mean like a little backpack of a reserve, because when I started my solo career, you can feel quite vulnerable if you're doing things on your own.
Mm-hmm.
So when I did the video for Murder on the Dance Floor, I thought, I don't want to do a video where I'm like looking like I want to be everybody's friend, because what if that doesn't really work and people don't really say nice things? I'd rather be a really horrible character. And then I've given longer to show a side of myself or not. And maybe I don't need to. And I think that's just been a way to kind of
protect yourself. And
yeah, I think so. So everybody's got different versions of that, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Gosh, that's really interesting. Coming back to your story, a few months after losing your record deal, you were asked to sing on Groovejet, If This Isn't Love, and it went to number one, becoming an extraordinary, complete success. And I actually read that initially you weren't too keen on the idea of recording it.
No.
And then you released your album and Murder on the Dance Floor became a global hit. And I mean, what a moment this was. When you say you were keeping it all together and you were sort of like your bandwidth and you have your rucksack of you on your back and you try not have the highs and the lows, Are there some times where you're just on a rocket ship and it doesn't matter what you think, it's happening? Was that moment then?
A little bit, but I don't really like that feeling too much. I think if I ever start feeling like that, I take myself out of it. That's probably why I spend a lot of time walking around, and that kind of recalibrates me. And it reminds you, you know, gives you perspective, doesn't it? And also the people you choose to spend time with. So when I think back to that beginning bit with my career, it's interesting because on the one hand, yeah, it was incredibly exciting and heady. And it definitely, I remember getting panic attacks when my diary first started really taking off, because I was just thinking like, I don't feel like I'm really in control of a lot of my days.
Yeah.
But my main memory actually is of the people that if I had a good person in my life, I would just sort of stay very close with them and talk about other stuff. So one of the people was Lisa, who did my hair for Take Me Home and Murder on Dance Floor, so right at the beginning, and I still work with her now. She does makeup as well now. But so we've been friends for over 20 years. And so when I was doing these trips and going to all these different countries with the album, she would be with me. and we just have conversations about lots of things. And I think that kind of, I think that's kind of where I find my touchstones always. And it stops me kind of getting a bit lost in the spiral of where is this going to lead?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Keeps your feet on the ground.
Definitely.
And your soul planted.
Exactly.
And so this was all happening and it was the turn of the millennium. And I think when we sort of had, you know, the sort of Britney Spears and the Lindsay Lohans of the world and the tabloids, and you were actually pitted, I can't even remember this, you were pitted against Victoria Beckham for the number one slot when she released her first solo single. You were still early 20s, right?
This is when I was 21. So yeah, that's in the summer of 2000. And it's quite funny. I mean, obviously, why would you remember? But to me, it was such a big thing at the time because it was on like the news and it was on the front cover of papers and it was really intense. It made me kind of ill. Yeah. It was so intense.
Yeah, I think you were on the front page. You were on the 6 o'clock news. And this was the sort of like the thing that we were all looking out for.
Yeah, it was like a chart battle.
Yeah, the chart battle. I mean, that takes us back, doesn't it?
I know.
Chart battles and things like that. And I also love that you, am I right in saying you came out with a T-shirt? What did it say?
It said Peckham, but that wasn't actually supposed to be seen. Basically, I'd worn it for a joke for the people that were performing with me at a Radio 1 roadshow. I just thought it was funny.
And then everyone caught, okay, and then everyone caught on to it.
And then I was about to leave, yeah, and then this one photographer came over and said, can I just get a picture of you? And I was like, oh, I've already taken all my makeup off and I'm about to go home. And he's like, just one, please. And I just got out of the car and did this picture. And then the next day I went to my corner shop and it was on the front cover of the paper. And so I picked up all the papers that had Groove Jet on the cover and put them on the counter. And I said to the guy behind the counter, that's actually me. And the guy went, oh, I thought it looked like you, but then it says she lives in Peckham. And I was like, that's literally not what that's
supposed to be. Oh, hang on a minute. This is all going wrong.
Yeah.
This is
I was just having a bit of fun after a very stressful week.
Yeah, I can imagine. And during this period of time, not only did you have this extraordinary career as an international pop star, but you met your husband, Richard, and started your family. And you have five boys, as you said, between the ages of 6 and 21. And I know, firstly, everyone's just going, how is that possible? You've got a very busy household, lots of different personalities. And I've been lucky enough to come to your house and it's this amazing place and full of love and full of
stuff,
joy. And I remember speaking to a fellow sort of mum of a superstar mum like yourself, Jules Oliver, who has five kids. And we were talking about the juggle. Do you slightly thrive on the chaos of big families? And I'm probably romanticising because I've got a sister and I've only had Harry, but I can imagine the house is, well, it's like a soap opera, I'm assuming, like not one day is the same.
That's very true. And I think, yeah, I mean, I'm a maximalist in sort of every direction, really.
It's what we love about you.
I definitely like my things. And collecting, not saying I've collected children, but it definitely works for me to have.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, when the babies were little and it'd be, you know, Richard, there's a space in the car, or it'd be like, I could probably put another bed there. I mean, I look back and I'm like, wow, that was so enthusiastic. and now it's funny because, you know, the eldest three are all taller than me and it's like, oh wow, you know, this is like a new chapter that's emerging. But I think family's always meant a lot to me. I didn't have any siblings when I was growing up until I was 8, and then my brother was born and I was absolutely obsessed with him. But so some of it was visceral, you know. I liked carrying him and having him on my hip and putting him to bed and reading him stories and playing with him. But some of it was more to do with the emotional echoes that come with a new baby, which was all positive. And I think after a slightly turbulent time with my parents' separation, and this baby symbolized the future and goodness, like wholesome, pure goodness. And it really meant a lot to me. So I think he was born, and then when 3 years later, my sister, and yeah, it just gave me a lot. And I'm pretty sure that sealed in my head this thing of like, I definitely wanting to be a mum, but then the the goodness that comes with these new little people that come into the family. And it's so neat because since my brother, I've never gone longer than 6 years without a new baby in the family. So my dad had my sister and then a twin brother and sister. And then I had my eldest and then I kept them coming quite swift. And then
quite swiftly
just,
in.
Yeah. And then just as my youngest gets to six, my sister had her first baby. So I've become an auntie for the first time this year. And we have my niece Alba in the world. And I'm like, great. The baton gets passed. So I'm kind of all for it, really.
Oh.
Yeah, we like babies and kids in this family. And the boys are really lucky because they obviously have, you know, their dad and I, but there's all these other people around them. And I like stepping back sometimes and just seeing all the other relationships that have sprung up that are so strong, either between them or, you know, with my mum or, you know, my brother or my sister. And very sweetly, my brother, the squidgy baby, he drums in my band. So I get to tour with him as well.
Oh, wow, so that's amazing.
It's very sweet. I know, it's ended up incredibly wholesome, I would say.
Yes, it has. It's like something that we would watch after Blue Peter or something.
Exactly.
Do you know what I mean? With our jammy dodgers.
Yeah.
You did something completely extraordinary and launched Kitchen Disco during COVID. And I mean, it was a total tonic for all of us. And we all tuned in to see you singing and dancing. And we saw your home and your children. And you spread joy like you do today. And, you know, it was what we needed. And I mean, it's still crazy. My son said to me, like, are we going to just like always talk about COVID? And I said, well, I think, I hope so, by the way, because I hope nothing ever takes away from that being our drama in our lives. Was it initially, because am I right in thinking you hadn't put yourself out there like that before?
No.
So when, you know, you've been on obviously stages across the world, but that was sort of, I don't know, maybe different. Talk to me, was it different?
Oh,
and it felt
different.
Intimate because you're quite a private person. And so we were in your kitchen with your kids and you.
Yes, well, that's all true. And I would say as well, it wasn't actually my idea at the beginning. It was Richard, because I was feeling pretty useless, actually, because I remember feeling like I wanted to reach out to people and I really needed music, but I couldn't think what I could do to kind of involve people or, I don't know, just find that community. I was just missing it.
Yeah.
And Richard said, well, why don't you sing along to some of the instrumentals and we could do like a party set? And I was like, okay. And it felt a bit crazy, really. And I put on a sequin catsuit and I was thinking, what if people actually think I've gone insane, but also what if I'm like reading the room a bit wrong? And so we finished the first broadcast and I was like, I think that's the end of my career, because I just thought, I don't think anyone's gonna think this is very appropriate. So when it started to resonate with people, it really meant a lot to me. And yeah, it's completely different to, I mean, of course I love music so much that it is the thing I do for a living, but the disco's kind of stripped it back to what music actually really does for me. And I think it just didn't feel relevant to be private at that time, because what we were going through was such an extraordinary, extraordinary experience. And it felt more important to connect than it was to retain that privacy. And also I felt like our kids kind of symbolized what was happening in lots of homes. You know, it wasn't about the kids.
It did.
It's not like, check out the face of my child. It was just like this semblance of like, family and domesticity. And well, of course I'm locked down with my favorite people, but my God, can I please get myself my own room? And I just going a bit loopy. And when does this end? And actually the news is pretty heavy. And then some of the advice is quite odd. And it's just a mix of things, wasn't it? Like all the time. So it provided a really good outlet.
And I loved how honest you know, you would be like, you know, we've been bickering all day and now we're here. And
definitely.
It was, I mean, it was stressful. I mean,
so
it really, really was. And then every day we'd have those, you know, it's going to be, you know, we go back and we'll not believe what we were, you know, looking at the death toll, just sort of going up on our screens.
Awful.
And now you look back at it and you think, did we, was you, I slightly sometimes, I don't know about you, but think, I had taken like a funny pill during that
period. Yeah, it's like trauma as well. And
it was. It was things that you did or wanted, you know, it was a different world. But that entire experience, I mean, firstly, thank you, by the way, because it really did give us light in that dark time. And you also then went on, because you're an ambassador for Save the Children. And in 2021, you raised a staggering £1 million for children in need when you completed a 24-hour kitchen disco. Is that as bad as it sounds?
I loved all of it except for the last hour and a half when I, because I'd got lots of advice and people had said that the hardest bit was between about 2 and 6 a.m. So I started at 9 previous day and then between like 2 and 6 a.m. So you've been doing it for a long time and it's nighttime and you're right in the depths of the dark hours. So I'd actually spent quite a lot of time thinking about that. But then by the time I got to 6 a.m., I hadn't really given that bit much thought at all. And someone had said, oh, by the time you get nearer the breakfast time, your circadian rhythm will kick in and you'll start to feel better. Well, that just didn't really happen. So I was like, oh no, I've not prepped for this at all. So that was the worst bit. But no, mainly it felt great. And also I have to say, you know, you're so supported and surrounded and there's lots of people prepping you and giving you encouragement. And, you know, I've spent a lot of my adult life incredibly tired and not having slept well enough. So it felt so nice to have this period of time for like fortnight after the dance-a-thon where people would say, oh, you must be tired. I'm like, God, this feels great. I mean, I'm always tired, but now people are actually being really nice about it. But like my youngest didn't sleep hardly at all. So I was like, yes, I'm exhausted, but not from the dance-a-thon, from my smallest child. Oh, yeah, he was a nightmare.
I mean, coming to another dance floor, which is obviously what you're doing at the moment with your fantastic new album, Perimenopop. Firstly, the name. Utter genius.
And I think thank you.
You connect with such, God, you just connect. I mean, this whole podcast is connecting with every midlife woman out there and it speaks to us. And you've given us all not just permission to be who we are, but the ability to celebrate it. And that's what I think is happening. I like the sort of evolution of this conversation about menopause and the fact that we even mention it and everything that Davina has done and other people have done to even bring it into our language.
Agreed.
And then now I feel like you've taken the baton on and now you're sort of moving even the conversation now further into something that's liberating rather than being scary or being worried about what it is. And I'd love to hear your take on that because I have my hormone doctor and we have long conversations about it. And I do recommend a hormone doctor to anyone out there because she's like, right, well, you're going into the menopause now, right? We're at the end of the perimenopause. You're going in, Holly. And I'm like, okay, I'm ready. And you slightly each stage, I get my results back. I'm like, what thing is going to happen? At what point is everything going to fall apart and all these things? Because you hear so many negative stories about it.
That's very true.
So I'd love to hear about this chapter of your life and this sort of, I feel like you're giving me permission to maybe be a bit more positive about it.
Oh, 100%. I think it's so important to sometimes flip the narrative. And you're right. There's been so much good work around menopause, perimenopause, so much really positive conversation, wisdom, information. This is all wonderful. However, I also think, firstly, it's like all the algorithms shift towards it and there's not really a whole lot else going on. I mean, you're in your late 40s, right? Okay, this is what's happening now. And you're right, some of it's about, there might feel like a conversation to be had with other women, in rooms with other women, for other women. Great. But I kind of feel a bit like making some men say my album title has been very entertaining. But also, okay, is this seen as like a sort of slightly private, slightly gloomy thing that's not very sexy? Okay, let's put it right in the middle of pop music, which so celebrates glamour and all those joyful things. Let's just put them together because all things can be possible. I'm a multifaceted person. It's possible. Yeah. That all of this exists.
Yeah.
And for my friends and for my peers and for younger women and for older women. So it's really lovely to hear you say a nice thing about the title because I felt quite bold when I was doing it. And I had actually really positive, like I spoke to my eldest boy about it. So I spoke to Sunny, I spoke to my mom, obviously Richard, my friends, and they were really supportive. And then just when I was deciding on it, someone at the label was like, are you sure that, you know, he's like, we could maybe make it part of the campaign, but maybe not the title. And that's when I was like, I'm 100% doing it now. Sorry, but yeah, this is sometimes you've got to do something for yourself. And actually, it's been really fun because I feel like I always write my albums like a diary entry of where I'm at, but I really feel like it's very much like including all the women that are around me and those that have gone before and those that will follow as well.
Yeah.
I'm not reinventing the wheel here. There's loads of amazing women that have done incredible things to beat down a path for me, and I'm very aware of that. But I quite like the idea that there might be a young pop star that might think, oh, maybe I can still be doing this in my 40s and owning it and not being shy about the fact that I'm no longer 22. Maybe that's okay.
Are you a small business owner? If you are, have you been onto Royal Mail's Small Business Hub? It is full of insight, articles and tips designed with you in mind. Whether you have a new creative business idea and are starting to bring it to life, are looking to grow, or perhaps you are more established and wanting to know your next step, there is information on the Small Business Hub tailored for you. And you might even see me on there sharing some top tips too. Why not take a look? Go to royalmail.com/smallbusinesshub. For now, though, let's get back to our conversation of inspiration. You said when you were 20, I hadn't even given it a thought about what in the future. And then here you are today with this album, with this title. And actually, as you said, it's now, well, age has just shifted, hasn't it? You know, you just have to look at the red carpet and you look at these women. I mean, obviously, potentially not completely naturally aging, let's just put it that way, but looking fantastic, doing what they want to do, but, you know, in their 80s, you know, yeah. And now we have got this different perspective and it's so healthy to think like that. And as you said, a young artist coming and seeing you, you know, mid-stage, basically, it's like, yeah. God, you're 40, you're not 90 doing this, and hopefully you will be. But also just even for us who listen and not in your industry.
No, yeah, it's not exclusive to that.
You're giving us the vote of confidence, though, that, you know, actually this, yes, these things are happening to us, but we can be
fun,
you know, who we want to be in this point in time.
And celebrate what's led you to this point too. And actually, it's not a coincidence that I was thinking back to that time, because that's when Murder came out. So I was, because Murder had this resurgence, I wasn't just still singing the song. I've been singing it since it came out. I was being encouraged to engage with its conception and how was I feeling then and what was it like in the studio, right. And how did I feel about the video and where's the artwork and all this stuff. It was going right back to the beginning. So I was thinking about that and I was thinking about how I felt then. And as it happened, serendipitously, I was also about to make my first pop dance record in a decade. So I was also thinking about my relationship with pop,
yeah.
And what tonic it's always been for me and how it does always actually make me feel better.
Yes.
So these were all things, and all the conversation with the podcast as well. So these are all things I was pouring in.
Yeah.
Like, you know, making a big recipe, like grabbing other things, other jars off the shelf and putting that in as well, because it's so good to feel inspired. Like that's a lovely feeling, isn't it? When you're feeling a bit charged.
Yeah.
So it's like, yes.
And it really is. I mean, it is quite amazing, because I think for a while now we've talked about vocabulary and having vocabulary, and thanks to everyone, we now do and we talk about it. And my son knows about menopause and my health. Do you know what I mean? All this stuff is going on. But you're the first person for me that's now gone to the next point, and now we're moving the story on a bit, which is now I know what's happening in my body. But, you know, and I laugh because and I nodded so much when I read that you said, and now I'm in my sod it era.
Yes.
And I just thought this is what this album is about. Right.
Definitely.
And actually for all of us, making us realize, right. So Sophie's doing an album about this. Crikey. So, you know, this isn't like a death sentence here.
No.
This is just could be the beginning. And I know you've got quite a I've read about you thinking that actually this could just be the beginning of the next chapter.
Absolutely. And it also gave me 100% permission to not tweak anything to present this pop album. I didn't have to try and pick up where, you know, because for a lot of people, the last thing they saw me do was a re-release of Murder. Well, I can now go, yes, that was me, but this is also me. And I like all those layers. I didn't have to be like, oh, do I still look the same as the video? Like, sob that, I don't care.
Yeah.
Like, it was like once I'd named it, it was like the final piece of the puzzle of like, and now I can just literally be 46-year-old leotard wearing tinsel epaulette, ribbon twirling me. I mean, young me would be a little bit horrified, but that's okay.
Yeah, your young me would be like...
I like being middle-aged. I like it.
Do you think about the future, and we're coming towards the end here, and what it holds, or do you sort of enjoy now not knowing what's going to happen?
Yes, like, but not a big planner, not one of life's planners.
No. So you're just going to let...
I mean, there's things I know, like I'm not going to leave London, that kind of thing, but I don't have any, like, I'm not a big, like, five-year plan kind of person. In fact, the idea makes me, like, get uncomfortable. I don't...
Oh, does it?
Yeah, I don't like it.
Okay, so you're just...
There's so many unknowns.
And imagine if you tried to plan the last 24 months.
Yeah, or even the last 5 years. Whoa. I mean, there's a lot of stuff to unpack with that. No. Let it all happen.
So you're just going to let everything happen.
Just let it happen.
Sophie, you are just such a lovely woman, and your day off
Ollie.
You give us to us, and you had a death with a cat this morning, and you know everything.
So sad.
Wanted to ask you before we get to the end of this podcast: is I use the analogy that this whole journey is a bit like a roller coaster, and I'm wondering if you had to put yourself in your cart with your glittery leotard and your ribbon swirling and, you know, with your whole family packed in, what would you say has been one of your lowest moments?
I think if I hadn't been a solo artist, then the Ellis and the Baxter would have split up from me a long time ago. We would all have our own solo projects by now easily, because I think the time I think of is actually probably the time that I was leaving Universal for the second time, because I just released my fourth album and it was a very amicable parting of ways, and they actually very kindly gave me my recordings back, which I don't know if you know much about how things work, but sometimes they can, because when you're in a record deal, the record deal owns the recordings.
Wow.
So sometimes you hear horror stories of artists leaving a label, but the label retaining the recordings, so they can't release it basically. But because I had a good relationship with them, I was given back my fourth album so I could release it myself. So there were some positives, but I just felt like that feeling of like diminishing returns and just thinking, is this the bit when I'm supposed to do something else? And actually it gave me a good wake-up call, because I ended up doing something very different, which I'm glad I did. But at the time it just felt quite, well, just quite bleak. I mean, you know, you just want to keep working and doing what you do, don't you? So I think that would be the bit I'd pinpoint, really. But I don't mind talking about it as well, because I think everybody's career has so many twists and turns.
And we don't often talk about those turns that aren't as shiny as others.
No. And also the general public, for someone who has a public-facing job, people have a short memory when it comes to other people's careers, and rightly so. And there's a good thing in that as well. So even when things are going really well, I'm like, this is just for now. This will pass too. And I actually find that comforting.
And tell me, on with wind in your hair and sequins on your face, what would you say? Mm-hmm. Oh, here's another cat. Who's this?
Yeah, this is one of them. This is Don. So this is the uncle. Come here. He's massive, this guy.
God, he's huge. Oh, look at him.
He's so fluffy, it makes me laugh. Go that way.
What would you say has
Don
been,
Draper.
I mean, Don Draper. Oh, gosh, love Don Draper. Wind in your hair.
Yeah.
Sequins on your face, glitter on your face. What
probably
would be
my face,
a high?
Well, if I'm allowed a broad brushstroke, then I would say last year, because it was just so extraordinary. It felt like a celebration of so many things, but beautifully free of any, what's the word? Oh, go away, Don, you're being annoying now. I didn't have any expectation of what anything needed to mean. I could just enjoy the success for itself, which is very unique.
Right.
So I think that, but if I had to pick a moment from that, then I'd actually go for the BAFTAs, because it was just such a brilliant sort of champagne toast to Saltburn and all the people within that and that moment. So that was really special.
Yeah.
Plus it was super nerve-wracking.
Would that be one of your top nervous moments?
Yeah, I think it would be actually. I don't normally get that nervous. I'm normally quite chilled. But I did then Paso Doble and Strictly. Terrifying. I mean, I got through it, but my word. Oh, I felt sick.
Oh, it's good to know you're human then, that you do get nervous, yeah.
But normally what I do with nerves is I just feign absolute relax, and I'll find the people that are more nervous than me and kind of reassure them, because I think as soon as you tell people you're nervous, it gets bigger, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. It does.
You're very unlikely to know. I also don't like it if people say good luck before I do things, but that's like a personal thing. I never say good luck to anyone. I say have fun.
Have fun.
Have fun. Because luck implies there's an element of risk. I don't want to think about that.
Yeah, no, thank you very much. This is going to go well, my God.
Exactly. Why do I need luck?
Sophie, you've been the best. I'm wondering if you might do us the honour. We've got to that point of the podcast where I'm going to ask you to read a letter to your younger self.
Yeah, and I hope it's all right.
We're just so honoured to have you here. This amount of time and with everything you've got going on. So I just wanted to say thank you.
It's all good. It's always a pleasure to talk
thank
to you.
Thank you.
Okay. So I wrote this out the other night and then I should have really checked it for grammatical errors, but I guess you're not going to see my handwriting, so.
No, we're not. It's all good.
Oh my God. I'm actually going to have to shut this stupid cat out there. I don't know what he wants. I actually locked the door and he went in anyway. Hold on. Get out of here, Don. Go on. All right. Dear me, I'm imagining you at 17. You're at school, you've started singing in a band, and it's all ahead. First, the good news, you are still singing. I'm 46 now, so 30 years ahead of you. Can you believe I still get to do gigs? Yep, still sometimes to be found on a tour bus all these years on. And extra good news, I love it. And that baby brother who's 9 is my drummer. I know. And in 4 years, you'll meet the man you'll marry, and you're going to have 5 boys. Sorry, this is a lot of information. I don't want to overwhelm you. It's not all plain sailing. There's some really rocky stuff and you're going to have to dig deep. You're actually a little bit stronger than folk give you credit for. And one of your best qualities will come in time, which is the ability to tell good people from bad. But you don't have that yet. You're actually pretty bad at that right now. Anyway, enjoy the good times. And please remember, there's learning in all the bad times. And all the experiences will lead to strong foundations and a genuinely deep appreciation of where you, I, end up. And the folk around you who you learn to leave behind are all part of that learning as well. I would tell you who those people are, but you would stop listening to me. I know you too well. There's also some great folk around you who you'll know still today. And listen to our mum. She still gives the best guidance. I'm trying to resist giving too much advice, as I know you won't like it, but I also know it's important you discover things on your own. But just to say, it feels great to stop worrying about being cool. You're going to end up making modern disco clad in tinsel, and your family life will make you feel so complete. You're still going to love Julie Andrews and Hey Mickey and Gherkins, and your house will be filled with trinkets and knickknacks, and some of it you already own. In fact, all the stuff that I rather enjoyed back when I was your age, I just take more pleasure in bringing out into the light these days rather than cringing about it like you do. But you're right too. It is how it is to be teenage. And I don't think you or the world or even Hammersmith is ready to see you in sequins and glitter just yet. Also, isn't it nice to know there's so many adventures ahead? I mean, how exciting. If you can be bothered, write a diary. It'd be handy to help you remember, and it'll make you howl with laughter as well. But don't worry too much. It's just not very us, is it? So have fun, no regrets, and I'll be waiting for you with open arms at the end of all the decades. So see you when you catch up. Love me.
Oh. I love it. I love it. Thank you, Sophie. Thank you for
my
having
pleasure.
Us in embrace our sodder eras, and we need this. We need remarkable women like you, and thank you for flourishing, and thank you for flourishing and sharing it on social and letting us be part of your joy, because it's such tonic to see you. And yeah, it's just been a privilege, Sophie. I like Aww. You so much, and thank you again.
Thank you so much, Holly. I'd love to read your letter to you one day.
Oh, I've got to get working on it. thank you for joining me today. If you've enjoyed this episode, can I ask that you share it with a friend and like, subscribe and review it too, so that together we can inspire even more people to follow their dreams to build a life they love.